memories. There are many who want help to resist the pull, to eventually be free of it, to remember again. We should be ready for them. Dr. Avantikar shaded her eyes from the sun that had just begun to peek free of the dissolving clouds with her hand. I worked with Hemu since the day he was taken into custody and never really got anywhere with teaching him how to resist the pull. Perhaps one day we'll figure it out, but right now even that's still out of our grasp, let alone how to cure them of it. The shadow slid closer to her on the wall. He felt his body cock its head as it thought with him. I have an idea, he said. The Shadowless reconstructed the sanctuary once they'd agreed on the plans. It was to be somewhat like a temple. The shadow and his body would watch over the grounds from where they sat at the entrance, and behind their altar there would be two great halls in a line, connected to each other by a long hallway. In the first hall, Shadowless, who had come for help, would rest and wait. They would take care of one another, and Dr. Avantikar and those Shadowless already in their group who were still quite strong would live there as well, to help protect them. In the second hall, Shadowless that the Shadow believed he could cure would be invited one at a time. He would stretch up the tall side of the building and enter to meet them through a large open space in the roof. It's not too high? Downtown asked. The Shadow shook his head. A shadow is not a body. I can travel to the other end of New Orleans from this very place, so long as there is light for contrast and surfaces to move across. The remembering of the two great halls was finished in a day, and a week after, the first Shadowless began to appear, drawn by what they had felt happen. In trickles at first, and then, once they had seen him, a strangely shaped shadow, who moved and talked to them as the human to whom it was attached sat motionless and silent on the bricks before it, the trickles turned into streams, then rivers, then oceans. Shadowed survivors began to leave, hope buoyed by so many arriving Shadowless they hadn't realized had clung to life so long, to try to find their own Shadowless relatives, wherever they had lived before the forgetting began, and bring them back to the amnesiac. When the tide of newcomers began to include Shadowed and Shadowless from other cities, not just New Orleans, because they had heard about the Shadow who had a body, not a body who had a shadow, that was when he became sure of what had to be done to save them. A Shadowless could still learn new things, and they could keep it for a while, whatever it was that they learned. An hour if they were weak, or perhaps a day, a week if they were strong. But much beyond that, it wouldn't stick. Nothing would stick without a shadow. That was everyone's mistake so long ago, when it was only Hemu Joshi. They were trying to make memories to give him a shadow again. It was the other way around. They needed to give him a shadow to make memories. Stating a thing doesn't mean it becomes easy, however, or even fathomable, according to Dr. Avantikar. She agreed with the concept, but had no idea how to proceed, because the dark halves of the Shadowless were gone forever. One could not create something from nothing. But that wasn't the end of hope. There was more to it than that. The Shadow led both his body and Dr. Avantikar inside the first great hall, and sat them down facing each other in the center of the smooth floor. His body's hand obediently placed a twig between them on the floor. "Pick up its shadow," he said to Dr. Avantikar. But she could not do it. It was impossible. A human cannot touch a shadow. If she puts a hand on it, tries to grip it in her fingers, the shadow will simply slip away, both under and over at once. Only a shadow can touch a shadow. Only a shadow who understands what it's doing and is not simply mimicking. Slowly, the shadow reached out to what Dr. Avantikar had tried to touch and failed, and took hold of the little twig by its silhouette, not its crisp wooden form, and pulled. Beside him, he could feel his body shudder with the effort, It was not easy to ask a thing to give up its shadow. He felt the world sigh as he strained. It was like ripping apart something that was never meant to be two pieces, something that didn't understand where the line it was supposed to break across lay. "My God," Dr. Avantikar said, transfixed. She picked up the newly shadowless stick and stared at it. Then she reached out and ran her fingers through its separated twin, perched stiffly in his own dark, untouchable palm. Her flesh slipped through both his shape and the dark copy of the twig as easily as before, a hand through smoke. He smiled as he watched her marvel. He thought of Hemu's notebook again, of Peter Pan, of when poor young Peter found his missing shadow in a chest of drawers and thought all his problems were solved. For the longest time, the shadow thought Hemu had included the excerpts because he was simply wishing for something that could never be, that he might be able to find his own again somehow. The outright magic of the idea never meshed with the rest of his fevered research. Even the rumors surrounding the elephant Gajarajan's almost mythical powers of memory still had grains of truth in them. There were photographs of the actual animal, interviews with people who had seen him, worked with him. Peter Pan was written as a children's story. It took until his awakening for the shadow to finally understand what Hemu had also begun to grasp himself before his death. Not that one's own shadow could be found again, because those were gone forever, but that they were far more tangible than anyone had realized if the right hands touched them. And if that was true, then so was this. A shadow from something else might be able to be used in place of a missing one. He set the ownerless little shadow down on the dusty brick floor. It lay still, lonely. "Can you do it?" Dr. Avantikar asked, no more than a whisper. "Can you bind it to something else?" She clutched the mutilated twig. "I don't know," he said, "but I think so." They began to try and fail. The problem wasn't that there weren't enough shadows to use. It was that there were too many, and all of them wrong. The shadow of a sparrow would cure a shadowless, but it drove them mad, urging them to the tops of trees or buildings, while the rest chased after to save them, until they finally managed to leap into the air, and then fall flightless. A tree's shadow would not take it all, and then could not be given back to the tree. The branches withered within weeks, mournful. A rock's shadow made a human catatonic, even though they could then learn and remember. The shadow of a house gave them great, aching pain all throughout their bones, until they begged it to be stripped off again. That was the worst of all. The houses were how they learned the horrible danger of their experiment. If a rejoining failed midway, if the new stolen shadow didn't take, or he tried to strip it back off by force, the shadowless died. "Maybe it can't be done after all," he said softly as they stood over their latest failure. The shadow hadn't wanted to admit it, but it was becoming harder and harder to believe. The dark outline of a salvaged car engine lay draped over the floor between him and the doctor, lifeless. It had begun to fade even as he tore it from the machine, evaporating. For the first time, he could feel himself lose hope.
"Don't give up," Dr. Avantikar pleaded. "No matter what.
I don't even understand what caused it in the first place. The shadowlessness." She tried to put her hand on his shoulder as best she could. In the end, she simply placed her palm flat against the wall, over the top of his outline.
"It doesn't matter," she said.
"Yes, it does," he argued.
"No, it doesn't."
He could feel the warmth of her skin as it seeped into the stone where he lay.
"Look at me," Dr. Avantikar said. He slowly obeyed. "It doesn't matter why it happened anymore. It only matters what we do from here."
He looked down again, trying to believe her.
You have to do this, Gajarajan. She called him by a name, and for the first time, it felt right. You're the only one who can. Gajarajan had told Dr. Avantakar that difficult day that he would find a way to do it, somehow, even though he had no idea how. He kept trying and failing. It wasn't until almost 2 years later, just before Zhang's army arrived at the wall, that he finally made good on that promise. He only wished that she had still been alive to see it. They had been fighting again, after damaging another shadow so badly as they tried to strip it from its solid chandelier form that it vanished the instant it came free. Gajarajan was prowling back and forth against the wall, and Dr. Avantakar was facing away from him, looking over the rest of the sleeping city, to keep herself from falling into the argument once more. Look, she said suddenly. He turned from his flat surface to see her pointing across town toward the gate. Is that someone out there? She asked. He looked closer and nodded. She was right. Another shadowless had found his way to them, the first one in weeks, and was now wandering aimlessly back and forth on the narrow bridge over the water, as if lost. He needs help to make it the rest of the way here, she said. Too far gone, Gajarajan replied. Besides, it's past dusk. The death kites are out. Since they'd created the wall, the death kites knew better than to fly over the city. They could feel the same magic in that thing as was in themselves. But outside its bounds, the night was still their territory. Gajarajan, Dr. Avantakar said. They come because you've called them. You can't leave them out there when they finally do. Everyone who wishes to remember again deserves the same, she said. I wish that were true, but the risk is too great, he sighed. He and their 8 remaining shadowless patients from the former facility were still learning how to work together. They were not ready for the death kites yet, if they could help it. We could lose many trying to save one. But Dr. Avantakar never listened to him. She'd stopped listening to him ever since they began trying to fix the shadowless. Gajarajan couldn't remember the last time they'd spoken without arguing. Each failure made them more and more raw. What about you, then? What about Marie and downtown and Curly and Buddy? Should I have left you upstairs to die during the hurricane instead, because there were more of them to protect downstairs? Yes, he said, but she was gone, marching stubbornly down to the front gate to demand a guard contingent follow her for a rescue operation. Let me out. Dr. Avantakar ordered the night sentries clustered around Davidia at the entrance. It's an emergency. Stop her, the shadow said to the captain from the wall beside her post, and she flinched in surprise at his instant appearance. His legs lay in 2 long dark lines across all the roofs of New Orleans. Dr. Avantakar ignored him. This is a rescue. Don't listen, he said. It's not safe. The guards didn't open the gate. But before they could grab her, Dr. Avantakar threw herself straight into the great bound wall of stormwater just beside it instead. It enveloped her at once, sucking her in like a riptide. But the wall had been made by their shadowless, for their own protection. It released her gently on the other side into a puddle on the grass. She began to run toward the bridge. "Open the gate!" Davidia cried. Get her back here before the death kites dive. But Dr. Avantakar had a head start and was already over the water. Gajarajan flashed back from the wall beside the gate to the dark chamber of the first great hall at blinding speed to rouse the shadowless for help. By the time he had woken them and gotten them outside to try to do something, anything to stop the death kites, Dr. Avantakar was already dying. Gajarajan and Davidia continued to watch the carriages as they raced closer, thundering across the bridge. He could make out a new detail by then, one that caught his attention more firmly than anything had in a long time. The wooden structures rode low on their turning wheels, as if heavily burdened, The shadow leaned back against his wall and looked at his guard captain to see if she'd also seen. They'd heard the rumors then, that he was seeking something.
"They're bringing a lot with them," Gajarajan said to her. "More than any other group before."
"Not weapons to attack us?"
"Likely not weapons."
He watched, transfixed. What could all of it be? And so much of it.
Davidia nodded.
"As soon as I find out what it is, I'll send someone to inform you if any of it could be what you're looking for."
"Thank you," he said as she disappeared down the hill. He returned to studying them. He had not felt hope since Dr. Avantakar died. The strangers were coming in a dead sprint now, as if being chased for their lives, even though there was nothing behind them. So many shadows. Every single one of them, it seemed. Inside his body, Gajarajan felt the heart beat faster. Whatever was in the carriages might prove to be very useful indeed.
Orlando Jong. By the day's end, Jong had been placed into a room on the second floor of an old wooden house named House 33. That was how things were divided in New Orleans. Houses had been carved up into private rooms, with everyone sharing the kitchen and bathrooms. Amadi was given the room next door. Vienna, Malik, and the two remaining Smiths were assigned spots in House 32, and the rest of the soldiers placed in open rooms across Houses 34 to 45. Living that way reminded Jong of Elk Cliffs in a way. All of them together in a little community, sharing chores, laughing instead of jumping at every errant sound. Whenever he went into the kitchen to get a piece of bread, every house got half a loaf per tenant every other day from the city, or fill his glass with water. They dragged up in buckets and boiled to purify. His heart thrilled to see so many other humans doing ordinary things, washing dishes or sweeping the floor. Amadi was standing in the kitchen when Jong walked in at dawn, after the army's first night there, bent over the cutlery drawer.
"Do you know where the spoons are?" she asked.
They both stared at each other for a moment, and then Jong burst into tears, startling her so badly she jumped and the drawer fell out of the counter, spilling everything. It was so fucking normal he couldn't stop crying. At first, Jong hadn't known if Vienna would be allowed into the city after they realized she was shadowless, or if the rest of them would be let in either, because they had been near her when it happened. But they were allowed in. All of them. New Orleans welcomed Vienna exactly the same way they did the rest of Jong's army, as if nothing was different at all.
"I need you to come with me for a moment," Davidia said to Jong, as soon as they'd dragged the carriages in through the gate and unhooked the horses.
"I can't leave the others," he said.
"The one who gathers. He'd like to meet you."
At that, everyone paused. Jong, Malik, and Amadi all looked at each other.
"The one who gathers is really real?" Jong finally asked.
"Yes,"
Davidia said. It seemed impossible. But Davidia was speaking not like one who had also heard the rumors, but like one who had seen the owner of all the names with her own eyes.
"The still mind?" Jong stammered. "The one with a middle but no beginning? The one who does not dream?"
Davidia nodded, smiling.
"Yes,"
she said again. The stunned silence lingered for what felt like hours. All the stories, all the things he'd seen written on walls, it was really true.
"Go,"
Amadi finally managed.
"We won't move until you're back."
"Watch the carriages,"
he said to her and Malik. He felt her hand in his own for an instant, squeezing firmly. He squeezed it back for courage, and then set off after Davidia. The walk was long, and she was always ahead.
"Keep up," she said to Jong over her shoulder, but kindly.
Jong tried not to gawk, but he couldn't help it. New Orleans was unfathomable.
Every turn was more surprising than the next. Some things still lay crumbled, but others had been rebuilt, either through magic or through labor. Zhang did a double take when he thought he even saw lights on in one of the buildings, but couldn't be sure. All around them, people talked in the streets, instead of killing or running. Some had shadows, some did not. Most amazing of all, the ones that did not didn't seem to be afraid, even when they forgot what they were doing mid-action. Before they could startle, another shadowless or shadowed person would come to their aid, and they'd be laughing again within seconds. "The one who gathers did all this?" Zhang asked. She nodded. "And more?" Seeing it now, he found it hard to believe that 2 years ago, he was afraid to leave an abandoned hotel because someone might jump out of the hedges and chew off his arm in crazed hunger, or kill him for the contents of his pockets. Here he could walk down a street with no planning at all and feel perfectly safe. Zhang couldn't believe he almost hadn't come, but he knew why. He hadn't wanted to do it without Max. "Zhang," Davidia said, halting suddenly at the top of the gently sloping hill they'd been climbing. "This is the one who gathers. Here inside New Orleans, we call him simply Gajarajan." Zhang didn't know what kind of person he'd been expecting, but it wasn't the one that he saw. He stood beside Davidia speechless. This was no Red King, or even solemn-faced General Emmanuel, and there was no fortress or palace, or even modest house. It was simply a man, of vague middle age, thin, in plain, well-worn clothes. He was sitting outside on a patch of bricks, in front of a little wall nature had left undamaged purely by accident. And over his eyes, he wore a thick strip of fabric, tied gently behind his head. "You're..." Zhang paused. "You're blind?"
"Yes and no," the man said. Zhang startled. His mouth hadn't moved. Davidia nodded when he looked at her in confusion, and then she gestured behind Gajarajan at the wall. Zhang turned back to him, but the man didn't say anything more. Zhang thought maybe he was supposed to speak, but words failed him as he watched. On the ground, the man's shadow shifted, gliding farther back on the bricks until it broke across the line where the red stones met the wall and began trailing up the smooth vertical face. The dark shape rose up, 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 until it was roughly its owner's height, but the man on the ground hadn't moved at all.
"Oh my God," Zhang whispered at last.
"I wish," he said.
Not the man, Zhang realized now, but the shadow. Both he and Davidia laughed as Zhang stood there dumbstruck, staring back and forth between the body sitting placidly on the ground and the shadow that moved and spoke freely behind it. Finally, Zhang stumbled, and Davidia caught him before he hit the ground. She helped him to his knees, where he scrambled into a clumsy crouch. The world was swimming in front of him. Impossible, Zhang kept thinking. But he looked again, and it was the same as he had seen the first time. All the rumors were real, but they weren't about a person at all. They were about a shadow. And not only that. Zhang peered closer. The shadow certainly did belong to the man, because Zhang could see that the two forms were joined at the feet and hips where the body sat on the ground. But it almost seemed like the shadow on the wall wasn't his at all. They looked nothing like each other. The shadow looked more like the shadow of an elephant.
"I apologize," Gajarajan finally said. It seemed to be bending down slightly on the surface of the wall, to be even with Zhang. Yes, there were definitely large, fanning ears, and a third arm that came from the center of its face. A trunk. An elephant's trunk. "I didn't realize I was going to surprise you that much. Lately, newcomers who have come trickling in have heard what I look like before they arrive."
"So you..."
Zhang didn't even know where to start. Is the man, the body, he's alive, right?
Of course, the shadow said. We're one and the same.
Are you controlling him?
No more than he's controlling me.
It seemed true. The shadow was currently moving along the wall and speaking, and the body hadn't been driven to mimic the actions. Perhaps if the man had wanted to move as well, he could have without snapping the shadow into following his form.
There's time for us to talk more later, the shadow said. You can come here any time you like. I don't want to keep you from your people. It was probably rude of me to call for you so quickly. But I was informed that you brought with you a great many things. Things for me.
We heard that you were gathering something. Something that had to do with memories and shadows,
Zhang said.
We weren't sure what.
I'm not sure either, Gajarajan said.
It shrugged its massive ears softly when it saw Zhang's expression.
But it's important that I find it, and perhaps it's what you've brought.
What is it for?
Zhang asked. The shadow smiled, or seemed to somehow.
To help cure the shadowless.
Zhang stared at Gajarajan for a long time, both his body and his shadow. They were nearly expressionless. The body, because he seemed almost suspended in a trance, and the shadow, because he had no face in the way that humans or even elephants have faces. But as Zhang stared into the deep black shade, spread across the half-crumbled stone, he could feel it. The shadow meant what it had said.
You can do it, Zhang asked fiercely.
I have, it said. Once.
The word lingered as if solid in the air between them. The thrill of the miracle overwhelmed him for a moment. But then Zhang realized what Gajarajan's true meaning was.
But not again, he added. The shape of the elephant watched him evenly. Not again, it finally agreed. But I think I can. I just need the right tools. The right thing from which to draw a shadow. Not just any item will work. I used up all that I had.
Zhang looked back down the hill. Their carriages were no more than blurry specks from that distance.
We brought books, he said. Thousands of books. It actually wasn't... I'm not the one who started gathering them. But Emmanuel...
He died, and I took over. I wanted to finish it.
Zhang took a shaky breath to stop himself from rambling.
Are they what you're looking for? He asked.
I'm not sure, the shadow said. But most likely not. I'm sorry.
Zhang waited for something more, because it seemed impossible that they'd come all this way, that they'd risked so much, and failed. But there was nothing more.
Most likely not.
He let it sink in. Emmanuel had been wrong. They were just books after all.
I'm sorry, Gajarajan repeated gently.
No,
Zhang said. He was twisting the hem of his coat, he realized.
Don't be sorry. It was us. We didn't understand.
The silhouette of the elephant watched Zhang calmly from the wall. After a moment, it slid closer to the outer edge so that it was nearer to him.
Don't think of it as a failure. All of you made it here. You've joined us. We'll find a use for the books,
even if it isn't what you'd originally thought it might be.
Yes,
Zhang said.
Yes, we made it.
Gajarajan retreated slowly until he was centered on the wall again.
What is it exactly that makes them not what you're looking for?
Zhang asked.
I'm sure the rumor we heard was incomplete, but as far as we knew, we were looking for things with memories and with shadows. A book seems to have those, if you take it both physically and metaphorically.
The elephant spread its human-like hands in a slow shrug.
Shadows, yes.
It nodded.
But many things have shadows. Everything, in fact, except for the humans.
And the memories? They're not real, the shadows said. Stories about made-up characters. I don't think... It trailed off. If the point is for the shadowless to remember their past again, if I succeeded in attaching a shadow with unreal memories within it, they wouldn't recover anything from this world then. They would remember a life that no one had lived. Zhang nodded. It seemed to make sense if he was understanding the elephant at all. But don't worry about that any longer. Your journey is over. You have been gathered. We are glad to welcome you home. Gajarajan bowed. Something pinched deep in Zhang's throat. It was suddenly very hard to speak. Home. It was a word he wasn't sure he'd ever hear again.
Come with me,
Davidia said kindly. I'll take you back to your friends before they start to worry. Zhang began to follow her, then stopped. Davidia said that you already know that transcendence is coming, he called to the shadow. Gajarajan's form sharpened on the wall as his attention turned back to Zhang. Yes, we do. A shadowless arrived a few months ago bearing the information. We've been preparing since then. Zhang smiled at that. This shadow was certainly powerful, in the same kind of incomprehensible way as the shadows that had disappeared and the magic they granted in their places were, but this one thing hadn't been divined mystically, at least. Gajarajan had learned of transcendence, the same way the Iowan army had learned of his existence. Nothing more than a message passed on. Well, I know there aren't many of us compared to the people you have here, but we did fight a portion of their forces once and lived. We'd be honored to add ourselves to your numbers, to help you defend New Orleans once they arrive. Thank you, Gajarajan said kindly. It rose up and unfurled its ears and trunk fully, until it had obliterated almost all of the sunlight on the wall. That is a generous thing you offer us, and I'm deeply grateful for it. But there won't be any need. What do you mean? The Shadowless will do it, he said. 8 of them. After houses and food came jobs. Amadi was assigned to join the wall guard with Davidia, which was fine with her. She began to teach them all archery. New Orleans had done an excellent job of hoarding bullets, but they were still a long way off from knowing how to manufacture more of them, and Gajarajan couldn't justify the cost for them to be remembered. Arrows were a far easier option, and they didn't erupt into thunder or lightning when loosed. Most of the soldiers were assigned to construction, to repair more abandoned buildings and to houses for anyone who came after Zhang's army, since they had all but filled up New Orleans' remaining rooms. It was good. It gave them something to do. Not that Zhang had been expecting a riot, but he didn't know how willing they would be to stop being soldiers. They'd been fighting for a long time, and weren't used to not having to. Emmanuel's ultimate goal had always been to reach a place or a time where they'd be safe, but Zhang didn't think any of them had expected it to happen so abruptly. One day, they were killing the Reds and racing south, and the next, they were all in houses, learning directions to the communal garden. But it turned out that almost all of them were happy to stop being soldiers. They'd dedicated their lives to it before, but not because it was their calling. It had just been the only job there was to be had in D.C. As for Malik, the city gave him caretaker leave to enjoy what little time Vienna had left before she forgot him. Zhang received his task last. He was cutting through the grass behind House 33 on his way to the carriages, the way he did every day, to make sure they were still secure. He was always worried about the weather or someone curious trying to sneak into one. The morning sun was glaring over the roofs, blinding white as it climbed. His shadow skipped through the weeds, jagged. It bumped into another shape and dissolved, like two streams of water meeting. He stopped short. Another pair of boots was in front of his own in the grass. "Good morning," Yoshikawa said when Zhang looked up.
The young sentry Davidia had ordered to run up to Gajarajan with news of the books when they'd first arrived.
Sorry, Jung said. I wasn't looking, I didn't see you. It's all right. I should have called out, maybe.
He grimaced into the warm glow for a moment.
I've come with good news. We've managed to find some space in one of the commercial buildings, we've already renovated, where you can store your books. A library again. It's not fancy, but at least it's got a roof and a door with a lock. We'd like to name it after the friend you mentioned. Paul. Gajarajan hopes you will be pleased.
Jung was. He was so pleased all he could do was blink back tears and nod until Yoshikawa laughed.
Follow me then. I'll show you the place.
He smiled and gestured past House 33 toward the small new downtown area. They turned off Lafayette Street into a building that looked like it had once been a pharmacy. Inside, the left half was completely bare, save several rows of empty medicine shelves, and the right half was New Orleans's only tailor, where people took turns in shifts to sew items the city badly needed, bedsheets, socks, underwear. Jung had never built a library before, but he had plenty of help. Volunteers poured in the way they did for the garden and the tailor. Some even brought a book or two that they'd managed to save in the early days. The day Jung started arranging the rebuilt bookcases into rows, just like a real library, he gained two more helpers.
Surprise!
Vienna cried as she poked her head through the door. Jung gasped, startled, and then started laughing.
Did you break out of jail? He asked her.
Nope, even better, she said.
Malik followed her in.
Parole.
I swear you'd think she wasn't.
He gestured at the empty ground behind her.
Teenagers.
Jung smiled at him.
It's good to see you both, he said.
He'd hardly spoken to Vienna since the day they'd arrived. Malik had become even more protective than he already was, trying to prevent anything from startling her, scaring her, hurting her. Anything that could force a traumatic forgetting, no matter how small. But Jung could tell that when she must have asked to see the library, there was no way Malik could refuse.
Over here, he said. He was more than happy to put her to work. Can you...
He trailed off awkwardly.
Yes, I can still read, Vienna snorted as if he was being silly. Don't give me the kid gloves, General. If you want to know something, just ask.
It's just Jung now.
Jung smiled.
You want to start putting the books into groups so we can see how much space each genre will take up?
Vienna saluted happily and made her way toward the mass of stacked boxes. Malik shrugged as they watched her dig through the first pile.
She thinks it'll do more damage if I hide or avoid things, he said. She'd rather know she's forgotten something for as long as she can remember she's forgotten it than not.
So how was she?
Amadee asked as she went over to her small table, where a squat paper bag sat in the center. Jung had knocked on her door next to his after dinner to tell her Vienna had come to volunteer at the library that day.
Just like herself, he smiled. I think Malik was happy, too, to see her like that again.
He felt better than he had in a long time. Today was a good day.
It was,
Amadee said. She held up the bag. Something liquid sloshed against a jar inside.
Guess what I learned New Orleans has today?
Is that alcohol?
Jung's mouth tingled.
Honest to God, real alcohol?
She nodded.
Moonshine. One of the wall guards makes it.
Promote him immediately,
Jung said as he jumped up to retrieve a cup from the other side of the room.
Taste it first,
Amadee warned. She pulled the bottle out of its paper bag.
The only thing that's the same is the name.
As long as it gets the job done,
he grinned. There was only one chair in the room, and then the bed, so they sat down cross-legged on the floor, facing each other next to the lantern, and Amadee poured him half the liquor. They clinked the cup and bottle together and went for it.
Oh, God, it's disgusting! Jung sputtered, laughing. It's like gasoline!
If only we didn't remember what the real stuff tasted like.
She took another swig and coughed.
Zhang tried a second sip and coughed again, too. He drank more anyway. That warm, floating feeling he'd almost forgotten prickled at the edges of his brain. Not enough by far, but at least it was there at all. It made him remember how it was supposed to feel. He told her about his day at the library, and Amidi told him about her day on the wall. She was smiling more. They finished the whole bottle, still coughing with every swig. "You're right," she finally said. She held up her empty jar and studied it. "New Orleans needs a new moonshine maker." "Do you know how?" Zhang asked. "No," she shrugged. "Only archery." Her eyes unfocused a little, gazing through the wall of their house, somewhere much farther. They glimmered softly in the light of the lantern. "I miss Tehran." "I miss Arlington," Zhang thought. Did he actually anymore? "I miss Portland," he said instead. But it wasn't really true either. "I miss Elk Cliffs." That was true. Max, Paul, Emmanuel. "It's strange to finally know you," Amidi said.
"What?
I mean in person." She smiled to herself. "Paul used to tell all of us so many stories about the two of you as kids or teenagers. His way of remembering you. Prom, the first car you wrecked, when you both got caught toilet papering your science teacher's house." For a moment, the ghost of the Red King had been there, but Amadee's smile, her laughter, was chasing it away. She knew only the old Paul, the blustering teddy bear with a temper that was all bark and no bite. Something deep inside healed over a little bit.
"Am I not how Paul made me seem now that you've met me?" he asked.
"No, the opposite." Amidee paused. She seemed as if she'd just admitted something she'd wanted to say but hadn't meant to. She smiled again nervously this time. "This is going to sound weird, but after all the time I had with Paul, all the stories, when you finally found us, it almost felt more like you'd returned again rather than just arrived for the first time." She risked a look at him. "It felt like you'd come back home." Maybe it was the alcohol, he told himself as he watched her in the dim glow of the firelight. But it wasn't. The stuff had been so weak it was barely more than dishwater. There was no clouded, dull wonder as he leaned closer to her in the small room. Only a focusing, as if everything around them became sharper, and time slowed down. He could feel the exact contours of her through the air from 2 feet away, as if she cast waves of pressure in the shape of her form. Sound contracted. Amidi had stopped talking, staring frozen at the point of his Adam's apple. "She's so short," Zhang thought. His skin tingled. He had never realized how short she was. Even crouching, he had to bend gently at the shoulders to reach her. Amidi had been right. It was like coming home. Something that was familiar. Something that he knew and understood. Something that remembered him back. That night, Zhang rolled over and was surprised to feel the soft warmth of another body near his own on the mattress. He opened his eyes and looked in the dark at the silhouette of Amadee's back above the blanket. Her back was different from Max's. Different color, different slope of the ribcage, different gentle outline of muscles. There were scars on the top of her right arm, a wide band of burns and darkened lines that circled her shoulder. For the first time in a long time, Zhang felt something like hope or happiness, as he realized that later, there was a chance she would tell him about them. There was a chance they would share even more things, and then remember them. He closed his eyes again, but in the darkness, without his being able to see the pale glow of her skin and the narrowness of her shoulders, it was impossible to know it was Amidi there, not someone else.
her warmth radiating softly beside him, felt the same.
"Did you get to wherever you were trying to go before you forgot everything, Max?" he wondered. "Did you find whatever you were looking for?"
He hadn't managed to rescue her after all in the end, but as he lay there now, with Amadee, knowing that the night hadn't been the last of its kind with her, but maybe the first, if he wanted it, it felt like an answer, just in a different form than he'd wanted. It must have happened after all. Max must have forgotten him, or at least some of him. Enough of him. Because if he had become a person who could leave Washington, D.C. for New Orleans, who could give up searching, who could possibly someday have feelings for someone else, it could only mean one thing. She was gone. Zhang wrapped his arm around Amadee and put his face against the back of her neck. He nuzzled her softly, to try to make it more real. She murmured, still half-dreaming, then dropped back into deeper sleep again. "Blue," he whispered. It was the last time he'd say it, but not the last time he'd remember. That was the cruelest part. Not that Max had left, but that she had forgotten. It wasn't her fault, but it was still cruel all the same. Zhang didn't want Max to forget him, but she had anyway. Now he wanted to forget her, and couldn't. Malik let Vienna come back the next day, and the day after, gradually relaxing as he saw how good it was for her. Amadee switched some shifts at the wall to join in. It made Zhang happy to have them all there together, completing their little family, but he couldn't relax. Whenever Vienna was in the library, he was afraid to sit down, to look away for even a second. He felt terrible for not trusting her, but he had been close to only one other shadowless, and she had disappeared once she began to forget, just up and vanished and never came back. He couldn't let himself believe that Vienna wasn't going to do the same. Every time she went to the tailor's side to watch them work, or walked outside to stretch her legs, or said she needed a snack from the communal garden, Zhang would make an excuse to follow her. "I just need some air," he would lie unconvincingly, scrambling for the door an instant after Vienna went through it. When all the shelves had been fixed, and the books organized on them, they painted signs for each genre, built tables and chairs, and hung up a partition to divide the tailor from the library. It took almost a week of constant work, but Zhang didn't mind. Vienna and he would have worked all the way through the nights if Malik and Amadee hadn't shown up each time, and blown out all the lanterns, just like when he'd been counting the books on the road. The day the library was finished, they held a small ceremony. Everyone that had come from D.C. gathered to see the books as they were meant to be, not hidden in carriages, but proudly displayed on shelves. They took turns reading from Paul's poetry, as huge swaths of fabric billowed on the tailor's side just above the dividing wall, the helpers swinging them up to shake out the dust. The verses were punctuated with the soft, gliding sound of shears as they cut, but every gentle intrusion only made Zhang smile. It wasn't usual, but it was more than Emmanuel ever could have hoped for. Transcendence was still coming, and they knew they'd have to face them, but for the first time in a long time, they all felt like they were finally home. Home. Zhang hadn't expected to truly ever feel that again. The day after, Vienna forgot who Amadee was. Amadee took it so well that when Zhang awakened in the middle of that night and heard through their shared wall the muted, strangled sounds of her sobs, it frightened him. He had heard her cry before, like when they lost one of the carriages to fire, but he had never heard her cry like that, and he didn't know why she was. The next day, she gamely introduced herself to Vienna and shook her hand when Malik brought her around,
and then did it again every time they dropped by House 33 or the library. Every time they met, Zhang heard Amadi sob again in secret later that night. Things started to change. Vienna got confused more often. Instead of rolling their eyes at him, Amadi and Malik stopped saying that Zhang was being overly protective when he scrambled to follow her around. They had started trading off, in fact, so she was never alone. "I know you're there, Zhang," Vienna said to him the next time he tried to eavesdrop on her from the hallway outside the communal kitchen. Zhang sighed and walked into the room.
"I'm just worried," he confessed. "I don't want you to feel alone or scared."
Vienna was at the sink, standing with her hands on the chipped ceramic lip, but the water bucket was untouched, the drinking glass in front of her empty. Its shadow sat lonely on the counter, without the company of the silhouette of Vienna's hands beside it.
"I'm not her," she said gently.
"Who?"
Zhang asked. Vague pain hovered in his chest, an old hurt.
"Whoever it was," she replied. "Whoever it was who forgot and then disappeared."
They didn't say anything for a time. The glass shone in the afternoon light, so bright it was almost hard to look at. Zhang wondered if Vienna had meant to get a drink and forgotten, or if she'd never intended to drink at all, and was just using the room as a way to escape the constant, crushing love they all were smothering her with. "It's not our fault," he wished he could tell her. "You know only what you'll lose, not what we will."
"It's a strange feeling," she finally added.
"What is?"
"To feel completely in control of your motivations, but know that at any second, absolutely nothing could make any sense," she said. "What if I'd come in here in a panic because my dad had just been shot, and I needed a towel to make a tourniquet?"
She glanced at the lip rectangle of fabric draped over the front of the stove.
"Honestly, that actually could be the reason I came in here. How would I know I forgot something if I'd forgotten it?"
"Your dad is fine," Zhang said.
"I know," she replied. "That's not the point."
They both looked out the window, at the backs of Amadi's and Malik's heads on the far side of the porch. The sun slipped slowly across the sky, its white light beginning to yellow. Vienna finally moved the glass a few inches so it stopped gleaming so sharply.
"We'll get you back," Zhang wanted to say, but it wasn't true, or might not be.
Gajarajan had seemed confident when they'd talked, but he hadn't figured all of it out yet. Otherwise, the rumors would be different. He would no longer be looking, or he would know what it was he sought. The strange living shadow was the closest anyone had ever gotten to understanding the curse, but he wasn't there yet, not quite, and Zhang didn't know how he could ever get there. If Gajarajan didn't stop seeking something and go back to trying to attach new shadows, he would never understand exactly what kind of shadow was the type they needed to gather more of to help him. But if he kept trying in order to figure it out, he would kill a shadowless every time he failed.
"I'd like to go,"
Vienna said suddenly. Zhang turned to her.
"I'd like to go to the sanctuary sooner rather than later," she continued, almost as if she'd read his mind. "I'd like to volunteer."
Mana's Amadi. Yoshikawa was already in the guard tower on the wall when Nuz arrived for the dawn shift.
"Captain Amadi," he said softly as she was almost to the top of the ladder.
"Oh, Yoshikawa,"
Nuz said, surprised to see him there.
"Where's Davidia?"
"With Gajarajan," he answered. "He came here just a few minutes ago and asked that she meet him at the altar." It was finally time.
"Transcendence,"
Nuz said. "They're only a day away. Gajarajan spotted their forces from his altar this morning at first light, about 20 miles to the north." For a moment, she could again feel the singeing heat of the flames on her as she had ridden past Zhang's burning carriage of books, her bow glittering like molten black lava as she doubled back,
urging her horse closer and closer until she thought the tips of her hair would catch fire. Looking into the red blaze for any sign of life, and not being able to see Zhang at all.
Are we ready?
She asked.
Zhang told me that he offered our soldiers his help, and Gajarajan declined. He told them the Shadowless would fight, that only 8 of them would.
She didn't understand it, but that's what Zhang had said. Yoshikawa nodded. Yes, they are called the 8. So Zhang hadn't misunderstood that first day. Nuz had no idea how many Shadowless were inside the sanctuary, but the Great Hall was massive, and there were at least 400 living in the city among the rest of them.
8 against thousands? Why not all of them? Even the ones who can barely remember can still hold a weapon.
The Shadowless won't fight this battle with weapons, Yoshikawa said. And it must be 8. We've been doing this a long time, since the first who heard the rumors began to trickle in. We tried many different ways. It must always be 8. Any less or more is not as powerful.
I don't understand, Nuz said helplessly.
Most of us don't, Yoshikawa shrugged. I think probably only Gajarajan and the 8 do, but we know it works.
She finally nodded. So there's nothing we can do to help?
There is. The 8 will fight tomorrow. But Gajarajan requests that you, Zhang, and Malik go to the altar to meet with them. They're ready to face the threat, and now that Transcendence is almost here, he'd like you to tell them as much as you can about their ways. Numbers, tactics, appearance, how your own battle with them went.
Nuz blinked. Teach them everything? Now? When Transcendence is just hours away?
She threw her hands up.
I thought they must already know. Why didn't we do all this when we arrived? We could have been filling them in for weeks instead of all on the last day.
Yoshikawa smiled sadly as she realized her mistake. The 8 are Shadowless, he said. If you told them any sooner than this, they might not remember by the time the enemy reached our gates. Nuz went to get Zhang first at the library. When they came up the stairs of House 32, Malik's door was closed. But before she could put her knuckles against the wood, it opened.
Saw you from the window, he said. Transcendence?
Nuz nodded.
Gajarajan seen them. We have a day and night at best. He wants you to join Zhang and me in the final discussions with something he calls the 8. Share our first-hand experience with them.
Malik nodded.
Come on in while I get my shoes.
She and Zhang stepped into Malik's small shared room. A half-eaten apple sat on the table.
Where's Vienna? Zhang asked. In the alcove on the bed, rereading the book you let her take from the library,
Malik said, coming back into the main room from where he'd just pointed with his chin.
Well, reading. She forgot she finished it before.
If I forget again, give it back to Zhang so he can reshelve it,
Vienna called. Then more quietly,
no point in keeping it.
Malik sighed.
Vienna, we're going to—
Wait, just wait for me, I can't find my gun,
her voice replied from around the corner. They'd given them up already, weeks ago, when they'd all arrived in New Orleans. The weapons had been added to the wall guard's inventory.
You don't need a gun right now, Malik finally said.
Vienna came around the corner.
Yes, I do,
she said. She nodded at Zhang, then studied Nuz thoughtfully for the 100th first time.
Isn't she from the precinct?
She asked her father. She turned back to Nuz.
Did you come to help my dad and Zhang and me find my mom? See if she went farther downtown toward the White House?
We're not, Malik grimaced, doing that today.
We're going to speak to Gajarajan right now. Zhang finally said to her more gently.
Oh, well, that's good too,
Vienna replied. She went over to the floor by the door where her shoes were. Nuz watched her start to tie the laces, calmly at first, then her fingers stuttered once. She'd realized she didn't know how she knew Gajarajan, even though she knew who he was, that she'd forgotten some things in the gap between her mother and their new lives.
Vienna, Malik said. You're not going. Only us.
Vienna looked up at him, one shoe dangling in her hand.
But... She looked between them, confused. Why are you going, then, if not to take me to volunteer?
Malik sat down slowly on the chair at the table. Later. Not this time. Nuz looked down at her hands. So Vienna had told him what she'd said to Zhang in their kitchen the other day. More than once. It seemed this wasn't the first time this argument was playing out.